Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Michael. I'll be reading this week's Big Bend Sentinel. These articles were published March 10th, 2021. USDA offers technical and financial assistance for winter storm damage. In response to the winter storms that hit Texas in February, the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS, is offering farmers and ranchers technical and financial assistance to repair and replace certain damaged conservation practices. NRCS is accepting applications for its Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP, E-Q-I-P, for the recovery measures listed below. Animal Mortality and Animal Mortality Facility, High Tunnel Systems, Irrigation System and Irrigation Pipeline, Livestock Pipeline, Obstruction Removal, Pumping Plant, Roofs and Covers, Waste Storage Facility, Water Well, Watering Facility. NRCS accepts conservation program applications year-round. However, applications for the 2021 winter storm recovery funding must be submitted by one of three deadlines, March 5th, March 19th, or April 2nd, 2021. After each deadline, applications will be ranked and approved as soon as possible so conservation work can begin. Producers must submit a separate application by one of the ranking deadlines for this disaster sign-up to be considered. Farmers and ranchers negatively impacted by winter weather are encouraged to contact their local NRCS office to seek assistance. Find contact information for local NRCS offices at www.farmers.gov/service-center-locator. COVID vaccination signups. The state is rolling out over 1 million vaccines a week across the state. Local clinics and pharmacies are now offering vaccinations, and Brewster County has launched a new initiative to vaccinate those who are homebound. This week, Brewster County has partnered with local medical personnel to get COVID-19 vaccines to any homebound person who wants one. To receive the shot at your home, you must be a Brewster County resident and may be homebound for any reason. Call the Brewster County Sheriff's Office at 432-837-3488 to set up a time. A deputy and a medical professional will arrange to visit and give the vaccination. To get on the waiting list at Highland Drug and Alpine to receive the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, call 432-837-3931. To set up an appointment at Prescription Shop in Alpine, call 432-837-3498. To join Big Bend Regional Medical Center's list, call 432-837-0430. More coronavirus testing opportunities in Tri-County. State-organized coronavirus testing sites are back in the Tri-County again this week, with special attention paid this time to far-flung communities. On Tuesday and Wednesday, the Texas Division of Emergency Management brought testing sites to Marathon and Terlingua, respectively. The last place this week will be Marfa, Friday, March 12th, at the Presidio County Courthouse, 300 Highland Street. The sites will run from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., or until testing capacity is reached. ID is required. Appointments are preferred but not required. Pre-registration can be made online at https://docs.health.com or by texting DOCSTX to 41411. These will be saliva tests. Officials ask that residents please do not eat, drink, or use mouthwash or tobacco within 30 minutes of being tested. Medical students spend spring break providing free health care in West Texas, by Abby Perrault. A free health clinic arrived in Presidio on Tuesday as part of a week-long trip by the Texas Rural Health Association at the Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine. No insurance or documentation was needed to access the health care provided, and locals turned out to take advantage of the unique opportunity. More care will be available in Candelaria this Friday for those interested. Students from the Fort Worth-based school gathered in Benito Hall at Santa Teresa Church in Presidio from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., offering a wide variety of health care services that sometimes are unavailable or inaccessible for Presidio residents. In that time, 24 students, accompanied by two full-fledged physicians, saw around 30 patients. Mallory McMahon, a student who coordinated the school's spring break mission trip to West Texas, said it was a busy day on the heels of seeing 30 patients in Terlingua on Monday. The medical students who came are on track to be doctors and are each interested in rural medicine, and hoping one day we can practice in places like Presidio, Sanderson, Candelaria, McMahon said. The biggest needs in this area are diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, McMahon said. Through the course of the day, many patients reported symptoms like tiredness, fatigue, and weight gain. With lab equipment they had brought along, the students were able to diagnose some patients with diabetes for the first time. The group offered screenings related to hypertension and diabetes, therapy for soft tissue, muscles and joints, wellness exams, physicals, ultrasounds, and diagnostics. They also brought more general adult and pediatric care. Another common ailment locals reported on Tuesday was physical labor pains from patients overworking their bodies doing manual labor jobs. Since the school specializes in osteopathic medicine, students were able to offer day laborers treatment that is simple to a blend of massage therapy and chiropractic work. The doctors from the school offered prescriptions not only for U.S.-based pharmacies, but information about medicine that would be available in Mexico for those who don't have insurance or the means to afford the pharmaceuticals in the U.S. Physician Dr. Bart Pate led the students on their mission trip in far West Texas. Born and raised in Alpine, he wanted to return to the area he loved and offer help where it was needed. It's the second annual trip to Far West Texas that the medical school program has taken, with last year's event happening just days before lockdowns began for COVID-19. On Tuesday, the focus was not on coronavirus, so there was no testing for COVID-19 or vaccines against the disease. The group did check temperatures upon entry to try to limit exposure to the virus and also brought masks and personal protective equipment to donate to any residents that wanted it. After a visit to Sanderson on Monday, the group headed to Presidio on Tuesday and to Terlingua Wednesday. On Friday, March 12th, the group will set up for one last clinic event at the Santa Teresa Church in Candelaria from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to offer their free services. McMahon was grateful that the communities in Far West Texas welcomed her and her fellow students to work with them. "For us, it's a learning opportunity. And every patient we see helps us be better physicians," McMahon said. "As much as we're helping the community is helping us." Carmen's Cafe given new life as boutique motel, by Kathleen Schaefer, Marfa. Carmen's Cafe sat dormant for years after its doors shuttered in early 2011. The restaurant's namesake owner, Carmen Hernandez, was growing older, and finding reliable help proved a challenge. She sold the building to her daughter, Elsie Hernandez, shortly thereafter. Hernandez wasn't sure what she wanted to do with the building, saying it was an investment. "I thought I'd sell it after a few years. I didn't really have a plan." Hernandez lives in Austin and owns a logistics business for trucking companies. But during a visit to Marfa, her childhood friend, Virginia Carrasco Platt, suggested she do something with the building. As a native of Marfa, Hernandez was acutely aware of Marfa's development as a place of tourism, so the idea of opening a small hotel easily came to mind. During the drive back home to Austin, Hernandez thought more about the prospect of converting the space into a series of short-term rentals. "You have a long time to think about things on that drive," she said. The rest of the development of the idea was organic, with Hernandez measuring the interior space and playing around with potential layouts. The only way it was going to work, she says, was to build out shared bathrooms for some of the rooms, or European style, as she describes it. She decided that the space would comfortably hold six rooms. While two of the rooms have en-suite bathrooms, the remaining four have shared bathrooms. There's also a shared common area. Before renovations began, Hernandez put an ad in the Big Ben Sentinel to sell off everything that had remained in the restaurant for the nearly 10 years it sat unused. She was surprised by how many people wanted old pots and other such seemingly frivolous items. "They wanted a piece of Carmen's," she said, "a keepsake of sorts, in memory of the warm donuts and huevos rancheros that they had enjoyed there in years past." In June 2019, construction began, with the Gutierrez brothers from Presidio completing the majority of the work. By the end of November, most of the renovations had been completed. But due to some unexpected setbacks, Hernandez's plan to open in January of 2020 was delayed. Then COVID-19 happened, and finding workers to finish the space proved to be a challenge. "I did most of the work myself after that," she said, "sanding, staining, and painting trim doors and walls in order to complete the renovation." Hernandez then had what she referred to as a soft opening, inviting her siblings to come stay in the rooms and provide feedback about what final touches and fixes might need to be completed. Each room is named in honor of her siblings: Elia, Elsie, Ruben, Armando, Leticia, and Tomas. Carmen's Boutique Hotel officially opened for business before Thanksgiving of last year. "Overall," says Hernandez, "it's been good. Some weekends are fully booked while others are vacant, and the pandemic has definitely slowed things down. I had an idea to do a grand opening with a branding party for area ranchers to come with their brands, but we'll have to do that another time." The building's footprint hasn't changed, but the previously white exterior, including the invitation to tie your horse and come in, has been painted a grayish blue. In one of the two front entrances, the painted vernacular map of the Big Bend region has been preserved. The map was painted in the 1940s by Evelyn Davis, an art teacher in Marfa, when the site was a hotel called the Yucca Courts and owned by Davis's father. Today, guests are greeted with this vintage message, also painted by Davis, when entering the new Carmen's. "Marfa, where you go farther and see less, there are more creeks and less water, more cows and less milk, more climate and less rain, more horizon and fewer trees than any other place in the whole U.S. of America." There's more work to be done, but for now Hernandez is taking it slow. She has plans to complete an outdoor grill and lounge area in the rear of the building, as well as renovate an additional space into a two-bedroom unit. "I want to keep it in the family, to continue it as a family-owned business," Hernandez said, and has plans to pass it on to her nieces and nephews. "It will create future income to ensure that they get an education out of it, so that everyone can benefit from their grandmother's building." Portillo Pleads Guilty in Phone Spoofing Scandal by Stephen Paulson. Devin Portillo, a former sheriff's candidate for Brewster County, has pleaded guilty to a charge of making a false statement after authorities said he spoofed Sheriff Ronnie Dodson's phone number to send out racist messages, then lied to the FBI about it. The actual plea agreement from last Tuesday was sealed by a judge for reasons that are not entirely clear. But the news was confirmed by another filing that week in which Portillo waived his right to a trial and said he understood the charges against him. In a news release announcing the plea on Friday, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Texas also confirmed Portillo's guilty plea and offered more context. During last year's sheriff election, according to the release, FBI investigators interviewed Portillo about a racist social media text falsely attributed but to his opponent, incumbent candidate Dodson. Portillo denied creating the racist text message, the news release states, instead blaming it on another person. But later, Portillo admitted that he had indeed authored the fake text message. Portillo, who is currently out on bond, faces up to 5 years in prison over the charge. He will face a sentencing hearing in June at a federal courthouse in Alpine. The charges, which the Big Bend Sentinel first reported on last month, stem from an incident that occurred last summer as Portillo, a Republican, attempted to unseat Dodson, the longtime Democratic incumbent for Brewster County Sheriff. Around June, Portillo faced a petition calling for his removal from the race after racist tweets resurfaced. Portillo blamed sabotage for the controversy and suggested his account had been hacked. When the Big Bend Sentinel found evidence that cast doubt on those claims, Portillo declined to comment further. "We're not commenting on anything else," he said. Just days later, Sheriff Dodson's phone number was spoofed to send out racist messages. Phone spoofing occurs when someone uses technology to misrepresent the sender of a call or text message. Spoofing is often, but not always, a crime. And if the controversy had stopped there, it's not entirely clear whether Portillo would have faced criminal charges. But he then also lied to federal authorities who were looking into the matter, landing him in legal troubles last month. Meanwhile, Portillo's efforts to deflect controversy on Dodson never quite paid off. In August, with his campaign still floundering from the initial Twitter controversy, Portillo dropped out. Will Draw, a write-in candidate, replaced Portillo in the race. By entering the race late, he did not have his name on the ballot and ultimately lost in a landslide to Dodson, earning just 645 votes to Dodson's 3,888. Portillo's lawyer, Steve Spurgeon, declined to comment on the plea agreement. In a phone interview on Tuesday, Dodson said the fake messages had caused stress for him and his family. He had to change both his personal number and the business number for his gun store in Alpine, he said. "It was terrible," Dodson said of the incident. "It's very hard to defend yourself when people start putting rumors on Facebook claiming he was a racist." He was particularly concerned that the messages had harmed his reputation and said it had likely caused some voters not to support him in his 2020 re-election bid. "That's what hurts." Ultimately, Dodson saw the incident as a cautionary tale about the dangers of technology and social media. He urged Brewster County residents not to believe everything they see online. "Social media is the fastest way to get things out, but it's also the fastest way to hurt somebody's reputation," he added. "Technology's got its demons." As Leach faces continued scrutiny, Millam's lawyer moves to throw out appeal. By Stephen Paulson. It's been more than a year since a local judge threw out a lawsuit brought by Jeff Leach, the founder of Basecamp Terlingua and self-described diet and gut researcher, against Katie Millam, a former employee who accused him of assault. But even as Leach has faced growing scrutiny and now also a criminal trial, that suit has continued to drag on in state appeals court. That case, which the Big Bend Sentinel covered extensively, started after Millam, who also goes by Schwartz, told authorities in 2019 that Leach had held her down and told her he gets what he wants. Leach sued her for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. Then several other women came forward with allegations against him. One woman, who has asked not to be named in reporting by the Big Bend Sentinel, gave an affidavit stating that Leach had allegedly raped her in 2014. Those allegations attracted the attention of prosecutors, who ultimately indicted Leach on a felony sexual assault charge. He will face a criminal trial on that charge later this year. Leach has also faced growing scrutiny outside the court system. Airbnb removed Basecamp Terlingua from its platform in 2019, citing the multiple sexual assault allegations against him. Last year, a reporter for Science magazine raised questions about whether Leach, who has collaborated with researchers at Stanford University and beyond, even has an undergraduate degree. This month, Texas Monthly also zeroed in on Leach with an article entitled "Surviving Terlingua." The magazine described the backlash local women, including Millam, faced as they went public with assault allegations against Leach. The story included an interview with Leach's half-brother, Perry. Perry told Texas Monthly he believed Millam. The details of Millen's police report, he said, had made him think, okay, that's Jeff. I believe this woman, Perry said, and I don't even know who she is. In spite of these developments, Leach has continued to fight his defamation case in court. After he lost his local court battle last year, he appealed to the 8th Court of Appeals in El Paso, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported. He requested the case be continued as a personal injury mediation, meaning a mediator and not a court judge would oversee the case. Millen's lawyer, Jody Cole, argued the lawsuit was never a personal injury matter and urged the appeals court to toss the case. This is not a personal injury case, she wrote in a filing last year. Leach sexually harassed and assaulted Millen, and then sued her for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress when Millen reported the conduct to law enforcement. The appeals court last March ruled the case could continue as a mediation. A spokesperson for the 8th Court of Appeals previously told the Big Bend Sentinel that the court automatically issues orders for mediation, which the other party can then oppose. In new court filings this month, Cole renewed her efforts to have the appeals case dismissed. First, in a 70-page filing last Monday, she outlined multiple reasons why she said it had been legally sound for a Big Bend judge to throw out the case. She argued that Leach and his lawyer, Ray LaFest, could not show that any statements made by Millen were false, and therefore that there was no such evidence Millen had defamed him. She argued that if Leach suffered any emotional distress, it was not because of Millen, but because he had a poor reputation from his repeated behaviors, including coming to the attention of law enforcement authorities. Cole argued Leach was libel-proof, meaning he could not sue for defamation because he simply had no reputation to lose. She argued Millen had a First Amendment right to speak about her experience because her allegations were a matter of public concern. And last but not least, Cole argued there was no defamation because Millen had told the truth. Days later, on Thursday, Cole filed another motion to add more evidence to the record. She included the criminal indictment of Leach from last year, in which local prosecutors accused Leach of rape. Also among the new evidence was the Texas Monthly story. The story, she said, contained new relevant information, including another account of sexual harassment of an employee at a pizza shop owned by Leach. In an interview on Tuesday, Leach's lawyer, Ray LaFest, said he was waiting to see how the appeals court responded to Cole's latest filings before filing a response of his own. I'll probably be replying, he said. I may not, depending on what the court decides. Regardless, LaFest said he felt confident about the defamation case. He argued it was simply not appropriate for Cole to introduce new evidence during the appeals process, and besides, that news stories were not admissible evidence. However, courts across the country, including in Texas, have generally ruled that news stories are admissible in court. Meanwhile, LaFest said he was also confident about the criminal trial, where he's also representing Leach. As he saw it, his legal opponents were trying to argue Leach was a bad guy rather than addressing the merits of each case. You cannot be convicted because you are just generally a bad guy, he said. I think we have a very strong reply to their allegations. In a statement, Cole, Millen's lawyer, said she would not back down when it comes to protecting Katie's freedom of speech and her right to be heard. Katie's legal issues extend to all of us who refuse to be victimized, Cole added. Many Texans do not subscribe to the old ways of blaming the victim, and we refuse to be complicit. Daylight savings time begins this Sunday. Daylight savings time is upon us, so get ready to set those clocks forward. At 2 a.m. this Sunday, March 14th, clocks will jump ahead 1 hour to 3 a.m. The change lasts through November, when clocks will once again fall back an hour. Father Time could not be reached for comment on the change. Daylight savings time will mean one less hour of sleep for Texans on a diurnal schedule. But in brighter news, the change will also keep the sun shining for an extra hour in the evening. That will mean longer days for late risers, and with the spring equinox just around the corner on March 20th, the days are getting warmer too. After a long and cold pandemic winter, that's no small thing to celebrate.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer, dated Thursday, March 4th, 2021. Business Spotlight, an in-depth look at local businesses. Christiana joins family law office. Following in their father's footsteps was not initially in the fold for Christiana Valadez and Adrian Valadez. Their father, Albert, was an extremely successful attorney their entire lives growing up, and although he may have wanted a few of his kids to become lawyers, the San Angelo native never pushed them down the same path he went. I didn't want to push them as kids because as a parent you realize that if you push your kids in a direction, they'll resist. So I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I chose not to, and I just sat back and watched, realizing they'd make the choice on their own. Adrian, the oldest of Albert's four kids, initially wanted to become an architect and followed his desires in the construction world out of college. After graduating from Fort Stockton High in 2002, Adrian went on to earn his bachelor's degree in business administration from San Angelo State University. The Fort Stockton native, who lived the first 2 years of his life in Houston when his dad was first starting out as a lawyer, decided after 5 years in the construction industry that the career field was not best suited for him. I was in the trenches in construction, and I talked to Dad, and he said, "Come back to Fort Stockton." So I did. Adrian then came to Fort Stockton before going to University of St. Mary's School of Law in San Antone in 2014. 3 years later, the 32-year-old at the time graduated from law school, which was followed by passing the bar exam. In 2018, Adrian moved into the Valadez Law Office, joining his father under the same roof, becoming what is known to be the first family to practice law together in Pecos County's 150-year history. "I was proud and still am very proud," Albert said. Christiana, the third of Albert's four children, took her own path to becoming a lawyer. After graduating from Fort Stockton in 2011, the 28-year-old was unsure what career path she wanted to head down. "At first, I didn't know what I wanted to go to college for, so I was trying different things. Nothing was inspiring me or fulfilling me like I wanted to, and my grades weren't excellent, so I decided to think more about it." She started working towards an English degree at the University of Texas, San Antone. During this same time period, the Fort Stockton native saw her brother Adrian change his career path early in his career, a decision she admitted was somewhat of an indirect influence on her. "My brother had just started going to law school, so a little seed had been planted," she said. At UTSA, there was this program called the Summer Law School Preparatory Academy. Christiana decided to apply for the program and by the end knew she wanted to become a lawyer. "I really liked what I was learning there," she added. "I always had the legal experience in my life, but I never had learned it for myself before being intrigued by it. That program really did it for me." Christiana ensued by going to the same law school her father graduated from in 1983, Thurgood Marshall School of Law in Houston. In May of 2020, she graduated with her law degree in hand before passing the bar exam in December. She then joined her brother and father at the Valadez Law Offices, officially becoming an attorney in January. "Since I was here in 1986, there were no other families practicing law, and going back before that I had known, I don't know of any other offices that had family members," Albert said. "We may be the only one in town. It's something to be proud of." Albert and his two kids are not a firm or partners, but they do share offices under the same roof, a place where Adrian and Christiana spent plenty of time as kids. The former 83rd District Attorney said the practice has a family feel in the sense of not only working alongside his kids, but working in the same building. He considers a home away from home. "A lot of it not only is in the family relationship, but we're in a building that's been a home to us for a long time. The kids grew up just a block from here. So my practice when I was a prosecutor in this building, and they were all here at the time, this building is kind of a home to us." The three had worked together for nearly 2 months during the time of the interview towards the end of February. In that short time, Christiana says they have formed a great team, the best in all of Pecos County. "I think we have the best team here, really," she said. "We have the most experienced guy. Everybody has different parts. Dad focuses on a lot of divorce stuff. Adrian does a lot of civil estates contract stuff. I get a little bit of everything. I get to learn from everyone. It's awesome." Adrian added that while they are not a firm, they still bounce ideas off each other and balance the cases they do to fit everyone's schedule and strong suit. "You can't replace any mentor," he said. "We really help mentor each other." And they all agree that their office manager, Rosie Holland, makes it possible for them to be a smooth-running operation. The godmother of Christiana, Rosie, has worked with Albert for approximately 12 years. "Rosie has been with me for many, many years. She keeps us in order. Speaking for myself, everything is lined up by her. Appointments, court dates, you name it." Valadez Law Offices offer a variety of law services, including but not limited to criminal defense, family law, civil litigation, probate, and real estate. County Ahead of Vaccine Curve by Nathan Heuer. In the state of Texas, 7% of the population had been fully vaccinated by either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine heading into Wednesday, and just over 13% of the population had at least one dose. Pecos County is far above that percentage in terms of people who have received at least one dose of the vaccine. As of Tuesday, March 2nd, there have been 3,671 people who received their first dose of the vaccine in the county. Pecos County Memorial Hospital CEO Betsy Briscoe estimated that at least 3,400 of the people are residents in the county. That puts the percentage of people who got their first dose of the vaccine that are of age to go and live in Pecos County approximately 28%. "We've been aggressive doing this, and we've been able to get extra vaccines over the period of time. One of the reasons we're ahead is because MCH is in Odessa. MCH has provided Pecos County with part of their share of Pfizer's vaccine from the state since the beginning of the new year, during the weeks that the county does not receive any doses from DSHS. Briscoe stated on Tuesday that the Wednesday, March 3rd vaccine clinic at the Pecos County Civic Center will likely be the last at that location for first doses. The hospital will finish out second doses at the location towards the beginning of April before switching back to the PCMH campus, the location where they first gave shots, in December. "From that point forward, we'll schedule appointments in the clinic. We want to make sure we have enough people to not waste any of the vaccines. So we'll set a time and say, if you're interested, let us know. And then on this date and this time, come in and we'll give you the shot." Briscoe is considering reopening the PCMH vaccine hotline, but has not made a decision as of Wednesday. Abbott's executive order takes effect March 10th. Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order on Tuesday, March 2nd, that lifts the mask mandate in Texas and increases capacity of all businesses and facilities in the state to 100% starting Wednesday, March 10th. The governor made the announcement in Lubbock in an address to the Lubbock Chamber of Commerce. With the medical advancements of vaccines and antibody therapeutic drugs, Texas now has the tools to protect Texans from the virus, said Governor Abbott. "We must now do more to restore livelihoods and normalcy for Texans by opening Texas 100%. Make no mistake, COVID-19 has not disappeared, but it is clear from the recoveries, vaccination, reduced hospitalizations, and safe practices that Texans are using that state mandates are no longer needed. Today's announcement does not abandon safe practices that Texans have mastered over the past year. Instead, it is a reminder that each person has a role to play in their own personal safety and the safety of others. With this executive order, we are ensuring that all businesses and families in Texas have the freedom to determine their own destiny." During his remarks, the governor discussed the incredible advancements that Texas has made that allow the state to open fully and lift the mask mandate, noting the rapid increase of vaccines. Nearly 5.5 million vaccines have shots vaccine shots have been administered to Texans, and the state is now administering almost 1 million shots per week. On a local level, Fort Stockton Independent School District Gilray Madrid said that district administrators are meeting with the Texas Education Agency on Thursday to go over what the new health protocols will be starting next Wednesday. We have a meeting tomorrow, Thursday, at 3 p.m. with TEA. They're supposed to give us the minimum health protocols. Right now, the minimum health protocols are from December, which is not very minimum-like. Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster added that when it comes to businesses in the county, each will have the right to decide whether to wear masks in their businesses. Governor said it will be up to the individual businesses whether they require a mask or not. The executive order states businesses may still limit capacity or implement additional safety protocols at their own discretion. If COVID-19 hospitalizations in any of the 22 hospital regions in Texas get above 15% of the hospital bed capacity in that region for 7 straight days, a county judge in that region may use mitigation strategies. However, county judges may not impose jail time for not following orders, nor may any penalties be imposed for failing to wear a face mask. A Look at People Traveling Through Fort Stockton by Jeremy Gonzalez. Checking on the black cat in his truck, Robert Christopher of South Carolina made a brief stop in Fort Stockton for some fuel, snacks, and a cold Mountain Dew. "Her name is Kitty," he said while petting his cat. "We're moving from San Diego, but we started from Charleston, South Carolina. We're headed to Austin. We went to Colorado, Utah, Idaho, Montana, made our way down the coast. I took the longest way possible to do a big circle around the United States. Once we get to Austin, I'll hit the 8,000-mile mark of traveling with my cat." Christopher said he will soon be a Texan by settling down in Austin and will be adding a dog to the family. Holding Kitty close to his chest, Christopher referred to their travels as a spiritual journey. "We're just going with the flow," he said. "I've been single since I was 30. For the last 3 years, I've just been trying to find myself. It's been a transformation. I'm not soul-searching anymore, but more so just going with whatever life presents me. Almost too spontaneous at times, but so far, I haven't fallen off the tracks." Before departing, Christopher shared his first impression of Fort Stockton. "Honestly, I've never even heard of this place. I'm just trucking and enjoying the scenery stop by stop. We're on no time schedule, so this was a nice place for us to stretch. But I can tell you what is awesome about this area, not just the small town feel, but the weather. You cannot beat that. The weather is awesome."
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, March 4th. Crash at Coliseum claims 3 lives. Driver had history of seizures. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Casey McCall, age 34, of Monahans, Joseph D. Hughes, age 44, of Sedgwickville, Missouri, and Daniel Pickett, age 48, of Graham, were all killed Monday evening after the vehicle they were in left the roadway, rolled, and ran into the side of the Ward County Coliseum. Ward County Sheriff's deputies, Monahans police officers, Ward County EMS all responded to the crash on State Highway 18 around 6:50 p.m. When officers arrived at the scene, they found a crash involving a 2000 Buick Park Avenue. According to a preliminary report by Texas Department of Public Safety Trooper Cody Gale of Kermit, quote, "The Buick was traveling south on Highway 18 at a high rate of speed before it left the roadway, drove through the Ward County Arena parking lot, and hit the side of the Coliseum. The driver, identified as Hughes, and the 2 passengers, Pickett and McCall, were all killed in the crash. A rumor circulating mentioned Hughes had a seizure while driving, but as of press time, the news was unable to confirm if the crash Monday was a result of Hughes suffering a medical condition. In June of 2019, Hughes and his 2 minor children were seriously injured in a single vehicle accident at the intersection of Main and Seeley Streets when Hughes had a seizure while driving, drove through the intersection, crashing his Ford F-250 into the northwest traffic light and pole, knocking down the entire pole and landing the truck on its side. At the time of the crash, it was confirmed Hughes was a diabetic and had a history of seizures. A gaping hole in the side of the Coliseum was left as a result of the crash Monday evening. Ward County Judge Greg Holly said, quote, "Most of the damage to the building was in the front and the storage room and a bathroom. The damage does not appear to extend to the main room, although there is minor smoke damage," end quote. Building repairs are estimated to take around 2 to 3 months, but the Coliseum will remain operational during this time for small events, Holly added. The cost of repairs to the Coliseum have yet to be determined. Ward County workers were out at the scene early Tuesday morning to evaluate the building for structural repairs. All three victims were pronounced dead at the scene by Justice of the Peace Elizabeth B. Polanco. Monahan's volunteer fire department were called to the scene to assist in extracting the victims and put out a small fire which began shortly after the crash. Quote, "The car wasn't on fire. It was a wood beam from the Coliseum which caught fire," Fire Chief Randy Crabtree said. The firefighters were able to extinguish the small blaze with small fire extinguishers. Quote, "We did cool it down some with the water off the rescue trucks," Crabtree added. McCall was not wearing a seatbelt at the time of the crash, and weather conditions were clear and the roads were dry at the time of the crash, according to DPS reports. Stout apprehended after short foot chase. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Police Department, along with the United States Marshals, apprehended armed robbery suspect Braden Ray Stout, age 20, of Monahans, on Sunday, February 28th. According to Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana, quote, "We received a tip that Stout was in the 800 to 900 block of North Betty Street at his girlfriend's residence," end quote. Monahans Police Department officers set up near Betty Street and the U.S. Marshals set up near Carroll Street. Quintana said, quote, "Stout and his girlfriend, Denova Korea Brooks, age 18, exited out the back door of a residence on North Carroll Street, saw the officers set up, and fled on foot toward the west," end quote. Stout and Brooks were both subsequently caught a short time later near the 1000 block of North Carroll Street. Brooks was charged with hinder apprehension of prosecution of known felon, a third-degree felony, and evading arrest, detention, a Class A misdemeanor. Stout is the primary suspect in an armed robbery of Microtel Inn and Suites, which occurred Saturday, February 21st. Officers were able to identify Stout as the suspect with the help of surveillance cameras. The investigation showed a white male displayed a firearm, threatened and stole U.S. currency from a Hispanic female victim, and then exited the hotel and fled the scene. An arrest warrant was issued for Stout, charging him with aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, a first-degree felony, along with an additional charge of evading arrest, detention, a Class A misdemeanor. Stout was also named as a suspect in connection with a shooting that sent two people to the hospital in Odessa on February 24th. According to a report by Odessa Police Department, quote, "Officers with the Odessa Police Department were called to the 300 block of Drury Lane for a shooting. When police arrived, they found Brittany Martinez, age 25, and her 31-year-old boyfriend had been shot. Martinez was shot in the leg and the head." According to Martinez's mother, Tina Ponce, quote, "The bullet did not penetrate her skull, but ricocheted and exited at the temple," end quote. Martinez was scheduled to be released from the hospital on March 1st, and her boyfriend had already been released, Ponce added. Stout has been charged with two additional counts of aggravated robbery, first-degree felonies. Brooks and Stout remain in custody at the Ward County Jail, Bond for Brooks was set at $10,000 for the hinder apprehension of known felon and $5,000 for the evading arrest charge. Stout's bond sits at $50,000 for each aggravated robbery charge and $5,000 for the evading arrest charge for a total bond amount of $155,000. Mask mandate ends. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of active COVID-19 cases in Ward County continues to decline, but one new death was reported yesterday, bringing the total of deaths to 21. There are now 39 active cases, down from 60 a week ago, 653 confirmed cases, 466 probable, with 1,059 recoveries. Active cases in the state are also declining, with 154,000, down from 192,000 last week. A total of 2.3 million cases have been confirmed, with 357,000 probable and 43,266 deaths. Wednesday afternoon, Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued an order, GA-34, that officially allows Texas businesses to operate at 100% and eliminated the statewide mask mandate. Holly explained on Wednesday morning what the order does not do. Quote, "The order doesn't prevent businesses from imposing their own restrictions in their place of business. A business may require face masks if they desire, and I assume many will do so, especially large chains. Please be considerate of clerks who have no involvement in those decisions. The order doesn't establish the operating rules for schools, nursing homes, or jail facilities. It states that each of these will be guided by their respective state agencies. For example, public schools will receive guidance from the Texas Education Agency. The order does not eliminate or declare an end to the virus. The situation has continued to improve, and removing these statewide restrictions is a step in the right direction. But the virus has not disappeared. Even today, our numbers sadly reflect an additional death. The order continues to strongly encourage good faith efforts to follow state guidelines. It encourages the wearing of masks when social distancing is not feasible," he said. Dress code committees being formed. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD has announced that committees are being formed at each school campus to address the current school dress code policy. Superintendent Chad Smith said each campus will establish a dress code committee that should include parents, teachers, administrators, as well as students. Committee meetings will be determined by each campus and, where possible, Smith, Support Services Director Jeff Jones, and Special Programs Director Doug Duggy will attend the meetings. In response to issues raised by parents and students regarding the school's dress policy, especially the hair policy, Smith said in the February 22nd school board meeting that committees would be formed. Dates for the meetings had not been set as of press time. Quote, "We are leaving it up to each campus to set their own dates. Anything in the dress code policy is open to discussion in these meetings, and multiple meetings will likely be set through March and April," Smith said. Individuals interested in serving on these committees should contact the respective campus and let the principal know they would be interested in serving. Some of the topics that may be addressed, but not limited to, are hair length for males and females, 2-inch rule on hair, holes in pants, 4-inch rule for length of shorts, skirts from top of the knees, 2-inch rule for shirt straps on females, facial hair, piercings for males, facial piercings for females, finger polish for males, artificial nails for males, possibility of moving to uniforms. School trustees approve addition of hallway. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. In addition to the public comments and Level 3 grievance hearing, as reported last week in the Monahans News, the Board of Trustees of the Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD conducted a number of other business matters in their February 22nd meeting. The meeting, which was originally scheduled for February 15th, was moved to the 22nd because of the winter storms that paralyzed the area. The trustees approved a contract change for one of the high school hallways. The proposed change, as presented by architect Scott Reed of Park Hill Smith & Cooper, will extend the hallway between the classrooms on the west side of the building and the band hall. Extending the hallway will cost an additional $693,000. Quote, "This change will provide a completely secure path from the band hall to a high school hallway to connect to other high school classrooms. The change also eliminates a narrow open area that would have been a very difficult area for drainage and improved security," Reed said. Architect R.J. Lopez of Park Hill updated the trustees on status of projects currently underway. Walker Junior High, Cullender Kindergarten, and Tatum Elementary should be completed in May. Quote, "Cullender could be completed in March if we can get the needed glass to complete the area," he said. Lopez showed pictures of the new auditorium and pictures prior to the renovation, as well as the student commons area after opening the area and removing the student lockers. High school Phase 1 started in December, and bids for the bus barn and auto tech area are expected in March. The new elementary administration areas, athletic area, and special ed areas should be completed in 2022, and the high school final Phase 3 should be completed in 2023. After discussing evaluations of the district directors, principals, and non-Chapter 21 business manager, the trustees approved new contracts as recommended by Superintendent Chad Smith. As part of the superintendent report, Smith said the total enrollment in the district is 2,052 students as of January 29th, down by 257 students from the same period last year. Tatum Elementary is down by 86 students, Sudirth is down by 84, Monahans High School is down by 67, Walker Junior High is down by 2, and Monahans Education Center is up by 5. The graduation dates for MEC and Cullender Kindergarten were also changed. MEC graduation date will be Tuesday, May 25th at 8 p.m., and Cullender Kindergarten date will be May 26th at 10 a.m. Both will be held at Estes Memorial Stadium to allow for proper social distancing. The next meeting of the trustees will be held at 6:30 p.m. on March 15th in the boardroom of the school administration building. Contested races for school board mayor. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The May elections for Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD and City of Monahans mayor will be contested races this year. For MWP ISD District 7, incumbent Quint Milius is being challenged by Rebecca Kynes. Milius, a 1998 graduate of Monahans High School, has been the District 7 representative since he was appointed to the post in November 2016 to fill the unexpired term of Kay Swan. Kynes was raised in Monahans and is a 1999 graduate of Monahans High School. She also holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Sol Ross State University. Both candidates have children attending district schools. District 6 incumbent trustee Nancy Upchurch is unchallenged for her seat, and as such, the District 6 election will be canceled. Early voting will begin on April 19th and end on April 27th. Ballots can be cast between the hours of 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. On the May 1st election day, polls will be open from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. Ballots for both early voting and election day will be at the school administration building at 606 South Betty Street in Monahans. For the city of Monahans, incumbent Mayor David Cutberth is being challenged by Adam Steen. Cutberth has been in office for 28 years. Steen has been a Monahans resident for 7 years. The election for council positions 2 and 3 were both canceled since both positions remain unopposed. Jeppy Wilson has occupied the District 2 seat for 24 years, while Calvin Carroll won the District 3 seat in May 2019. Early voting will be held April 19th to 23rd at the City Hall Council Chambers, located at 112 West 2nd Street, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. on April 26th and 27th. The May 1st election will be held in conjunction with the school board election on Saturday, May 1st, at the Monahans Wicked Pyote Administration Building, located at 606 South Betty Street, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monahans man killed in last week's double fatality identified. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Jerry D. Roberts, age 81, of Monahans, was killed on February 23rd in a head-on crash near mile marker 77 on Interstate 20. According to a report by Texas Department of Public Safety Trooper Carolyn Boyett of Monahans, Roberts was driving a Jeep Nitro west the wrong way in the eastbound lanes of I-20 about 7:17 p.m. while three other vehicles were traveling east in the eastbound lanes of I-20 at the same time. The vehicle Roberts was driving collided head-on with a Honda Accord being driven by Carlos Palma, age 45, of Roswell, New Mexico. This crash caused William P. Murphy, age 31, of Carlsbad, New Mexico, who was driving a 2008 Ford pickup, to take evasive action and roll his truck, while Orlando S. Payne, age 45, of Big Spring, who was driving a 2017 Ford pickup truck, to hit debris in the roadway between the first two vehicles. Roberts and Palma were both pronounced deceased at the scene by Justice of the Peace Elizabeth B. Polanco. Payne and Murphy were not injured during the crash. The weather was clear and dry, and all four drivers were wearing their seatbelts at the time of the crash, according to the DPS report. Boyette was assisted in the crash by Ward County Sheriff's Department deputies, Ward County EMS, and Texas Department of Transportation workers. DPS is still investigating the crash, and no further information is available at this time.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.